This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Oil, for starters, a little bit of shipping to continue, and then more printer ink cartridges than you can shake a stick at. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the second day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. With the stipulation that chart and graph interpretation can be tricky when your chosen medium is audio, we are going to get going today with a little chart and graph interpretation. We're talking something called the crack spread, the difference between the price of crude oil and what it costs to refine it. You look at a chart of the spread, as I did yesterday, I went across my social feed at some point, and you see the spread got ridiculously wide just after Russia invaded Ukraine, leading to, as we all noticed, ridiculously high gas prices back then, too. The crack spread is now at what you might call the high end of normal, so we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to explain what's going on.
Okay, gas prices are high, but it's probably not refiners just price gouging. It's basic economics.
Increases in the crack spread that we've seen recently has been just supply and demand.
That's Christopher Knittel. He teaches applied economics at MIT. He says with the war in Ukraine on top of some refineries in the United States being offline since COVID, the world simply didn't have the refining capacity to keep up with demand for fuel.
The supply curve gets really steep and we move up that supply curve and prices go up.
Retail prices, like for a gallon of gas. Now, you got to remember that 60% of gasoline prices are determined by the price of crude oil. 25% is the refining, distribution, and marketing of that oil. In other words, the crack spread. And while refining costs have gone up due to supply chain and logistics issues that we've told you all about, Jason Gabelman at Cowen says the current crack spread is definitely wide enough to offset those costs and then some.
Even though they've come off, they're still historically strong margins, double what they typically are for this time of year. So these guys are making money hand over fist right now.
But he doesn't blame them for doing so. That's the way it works. Refiners are price takers. They can't affect commodities markets. Crack spreads widen when anything disrupts refining capacity. Jeff Barron's an economist at the U.S. Energy Information Administration. He says, historically, we've seen this when a hurricane hits Texas and Louisiana and knocks some refineries offline. Some of those never come back.
So those refiners that, let's say, do not get affected by a hurricane in those time periods, they receive higher revenues because they are able to meet the demands of their customers, right?
He says refiners will continue to operate at full capacity as long as they're able to. It's extremely profitable to do so right now. And in terms of the price that you're paying for gasoline coming down over the past few months, sure, crude oil is cheaper, but some of that decline has indeed been due to the slimming of the crack spread. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I'll do it here because I know you're curious and Euler probably didn't have time. Crude oil today, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, $94.25 a barrel today in New York. Gas, says AAA, $4.18.9 a gallon on national average. On Wall Street today, the spread was decidedly negative. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A word here about the current state of the global supply chain. Profitable. Here are some more words. Really, really profitable. The giant shipping conglomerate Maersk now says it's going to make even more money this year than it had been thinking, $37 billion, up from $24 billion. Marketplace's Lily Jamali is on the supply chain desk today.
The global supply chain in 2022?
Yeah, so it feels a lot like it did in 2021, unfortunately.
That is not great, says HSBC's Eric Fish. And sentiment among his clients even sounds a lot like it did in 2021.
More of, we have to get over this period of the next 6 months.
They're working through a glut while continuing to import more. The cost to ship in a 40-foot shipping container surged above $20,000 last year, according to Reuters. The cost today?
Significantly less than those peak numbers, but significantly higher than historical averages.
In June, Maersk said that shipping costs probably won't come down soon. Without singling out Maersk, President Joe Biden has said those costs are fueling inflation. Morris Cohen of Penn's Wharton School calls today's supply chain woes a systemic problem.
That is occurring globally across multiple industries and multiple geographies,
resulting in all kinds of shortages, says George Washington University's Diana Furchtgott-Roth. Take flour.
The higher price of flour is due to the war in Ukraine, whereas the semiconductor chip problem is due to slowdowns in China.
Many companies are still figuring out whether to change the supply chains they've relied on for so long, says the University of Arkansas's Donnie Williams. They're scoping out the whims of the American consumer.
I don't think anybody's really confident if our buying patterns are a long-term phenomenon yet, and we're already starting to see some of those easing up.
Williams says plenty of companies might remain in this extended holding pattern because the state of the supply chain 6 months from now is anyone's guess. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Talked a bit the past week or so about the big reconciliation package moving through Congress, the Schumer-Manchin surprise compromise bill that includes $369 billion to fight climate change and would cut, say the Democrats whose bill it is, it would cut the country's carbon emissions by about 40% by 2030. Corporate America has been making pledges of its own the past few years, so I went out to Nashville a couple of weeks ago to see how a company goes about meeting its climate goals. We are technically 25 minutes outside Nashville in a giant industrial park in Laverne, Tennessee. Huge warehouse-looking spaces, shipping containers all around.
455, sweet E. That's us.
And then, having, of course, gone the wrong way around this huge building, we finally found the place we were looking for.
Good morning, Kai. James McCall.
Good to see you, James.
Chief Sustainability Officer. Nice to meet you this morning.
How you doing?
So, welcome here to our HP Ink Recycling Facility.
Thank you. So how do I get a fancy vest and the eye goggles?
Let's get started there. Let's get you guys set up with some safety equipment.
Let's do that.
I need that gear to get inside an 80,000 square foot ink cartridge recycling facility run by HP Ink and Sims Lifecycle Services. HP has a goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2040, and their term is across the value chain, which basically means the whole supply chain, plus the emissions that come from using their products at home. James McCall, HP's Chief Sustainability Officer, is our guy.
HP has committed that we will get 75% of our raw materials from circular sources in the next 10 years.
Circular sources. Define your terms.
So the way that we think about it is anything that's coming from a recycled source or coming from a renewable source or that's getting a second life. So like these ink cartridges, what we want is we want to take this plastic and turn it back into the next device, whether that's the next printer, the next PC, or the next ink cartridge. We want to have that plastic live a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth time.
Ink cartridges, we should say here, are a huge part of HP's business model because unlike a printer or a PC, you got to keep on going out and buying ink cartridges all the time. Through last year, HP has made more than 5.4 billion of them. 5.4 billion ink cartridges. The 30 people who work at this facility sort the used cartridges. They disassemble them. They salvage the precious metals inside and then shred the plastic to make new. And it's not just the at-home printer cartridges we all know that we're talking about here. It's bigger ones from offices and huge ones that I had never seen before used to print banners and things like that. It all starts with consumers mailing their old cartridges back to HP or maybe dropping them off at a retailer like Staples or maybe Walmart.
We process nearly 100,000 cartridges a day at this facility.
I'm sorry, 100,000 a day?
Yes, a day.
Although now looking out over the, and I can only call this a sea of ink cartridge, like these are return envelopes, right?
These are. And so we get return envelopes through things like the U.S. mail from customers.
The cartridges in this plant have come to Tennessee from all across the United States and Canada and Mexico, and eventually make their way into giant cardboard bins stacked up on pallets and racks, floor to ceiling, six decks high around the facility.
Let's ask Will. Will, how many cartridges
Will,
are
Will,
in this
box?
Will,
come here. Wait, let's get the expert.
So, Will.
Will, first of all, tell me who you are, Will.
I'm the site manager for Sims Lifecycle Services here in Laverne.
So you're the guy who actually knows what's going on. I mean, no offense, James, right?
You're right.
Okay, so how many of these cartridges do you think are in this one box here?
Somewhere between 20 and 30,000.
So net-net, right now, on a, what is this, Thursday? On a Thursday morning at 10 o'clock, how many of these cartridges, either these, the personal printers or the corporate printers or the ones in from grandma and the kids, how many figure are sitting here right now? Guess.
That is a rough number.
Yeah.
45 million, if I had a guess.
That's unbelievable.
Yes.
I mean, I don't doubt you. It's just,
and the majority of the reason that we're
Step one here is sorting those 4 or 5 million cartridges by type. There's a conveyor belt camera system that does that. And then it spits them out into different buckets based on size and shape.
We've learned our way into this process. Yeah. If you think about the early days, there was no ink recycling system.
Right.
Several years ago, HP had to kind of invent this as we went along. And literally, when I say invent, some of our first test models were taking an old washing machine and starting to put cartridges in it and see if we could clean them. We had borrowed a
that's actually funny.
We borrowed a chicken processing line from Tyson, and we figured out if we could use that for sorting processes and sorting ink and things like that. So what you're seeing now is the second and third generation of that.
Once the cartridges are sorted, they head to the other side of the building to get taken apart. It's louder and a bit more high-tech, too.
We actually cut the sticker off the top, right? So you want to scrape the sticker
just
off the label.
Slice it?
It's just pushed off, right, as you would slice it
They're
off.
Going.
In the second step, we're going to remove the lid. Again, we're pushing the lid off. The reason we're doing that is that exposes the internals, right? So now I can take the foam that holds the ink out.
If you ever wondered what the inside of an ink cartridge looks like, this is the place to be.
Absolutely. After I take the foam out, the next step in the process is to remove the electronics. The printhead itself includes a lot of high precious metals, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So
look
we want to be able
right?
to
yeah.
get these precious metals, these golds, these tungstens, these other things back out. And then you're left with
and
just
the
black
thing.
Cartridge, the
right.
outside cartridge.
Right.
And we're doing this hundreds a minute at scale. So.
Right, right. This is crazy. Wow.
The average ink cartridge usually spends 2 to 3 months in Laverne. The finished product that comes out of here, which is the shredded plastic, right? It takes another trip to a plant in Canada where it gets mixed with other recycled plastics and then takes another trip to a factory in Malaysia or China to make new cartridges that then go to market.
HP's seen our sustainable sales grow from $1 billion a few years ago to 1.6 to last year we had $3.5 billion in sales linked back to sustainable sourcing.
All right, but what are HP's overall sales?
We're probably about a $50 billion company. So.
Right, so less than 10%. I say that only to point out the scale of the challenge.
I think the scale of the challenge is there, but I think the opportunity is ahead of us, right? As customers start to shift and make these choices, you're also seeing industry change and customers change as we start to rethink this. Because that's what it's going to take, is it's going to take us rethinking the overall supply chain.
You've been doing this a long time, 25-something years, right?
26 years.
26 years. How are we doing? Not we, you and me, and not we, HP, but we, the American economy. I mean, you're a trained observer of this stuff.
I think what we have to put in context is 20 years ago, people were barely talking about sustainability and people were barely talking about circular economy.
I should tell you, getting ready for this interview was the first time I had ever heard the phrase circular economy.
Well,
and maybe that's on me, but it's an us problem, right?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem, right? Is it does take solutions all the way from manufacturers like HP and us thinking and innovating circular all the way through to the consumer like you. And we've got to be able to close that loop. But what encourages me, you ask me how are we doing? You and I grew up in a world where we didn't recycle because it didn't really exist and the infrastructure didn't exist. Yeah. If you look at my teenage kids now, they would be horrified to throw a plastic bottle in a trash can. They go around and pick up other people's plastic bottles and recycle them.
My daughter turns off the lights all the time when I'm sitting in the room.
It gives me hope, Kai, because if I look at the next generation, they already get it. So that's the shift we've seen in the last 10 years. Imagine where we're going to be in 10 more years.
James, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We did check, by the way, Marketplace World Headquarters here in Los Angeles. We do indeed send our used ink cartridges back to HP for recycling. We've got some pictures from that facility. You can see those giant boxes and all the rest full of thousands of return envelopes. That's up at our website, marketplace.org. I can't tell you how many ink cartridges were in that building. Anyway, coming up.
We are lean and mean, and we plan to stay that way, and it's hard.
A slowing economy ain't easy, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 402 today, 1.2%, 32,396. The NASDAQ down 20 points, about 0.2%, 12,348. The S&P 500 off 27, nearly 0.7%, 4,091. Andy Euler. I was talking about the crack spread, so checking in on some petroleum stocks. Chevron fell 0.8% today. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips both lost about 0.4%. We were hearing from Lily Jamali about the ongoing woes of the global supply chain. So, shipping stocks. Shall we? Seanergy. Maritime Corporation dipped 0.4%. Star Bulk Carriers Corporation sank 2.5%. Whole Foods has chosen 10 independent food and personal care brands to take part in an accelerator program for regional emerging producers, including, get this, a beet jerky maker and one that sells non-dairy yogurt based on chickpeas. Amazon, which owns Whole Foods and is, we have to tell you here, it's the rules, a marketplace underwriter, soured 0.9% today. Bonds yield on the 10-year 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart.
Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is more rain in the forecast this week for eastern Kentucky. The National Weather Service has one of those hazardous weather conditions warnings on its forecast page. At least 37 people are known to have died so far after about a foot of rain fell last week. Many more are still unaccounted for in the flooding that followed. Hundreds of homes are damaged, if not destroyed, and people are just starting to figure out what to do next. Flood insurance is one of the main ways that people rebuild and recover financially after a flood. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, not many people have it.
Very few people in the U.S. have flood insurance.
In the country, we only have 4 out of 100 homes covered by flood insurance.
Paul Huang is with the Federal Insurance and Mitigation Administration, which is part of FEMA. He says in all of eastern Kentucky,
we only have a couple hundred policies
total, which means most people whose homes were damaged or destroyed in the last week probably won't be covered.
This is very typical of inland communities that face these sudden, tragic flood events.
Mark Friedlander is with the nonprofit Insurance Information Institute.
Even though we're seeing more weather events that are causing significant flooding in inland communities, we have not really seen much of a change in terms of the percentage of homeowners who have flood coverage.
People are only required to have flood insurance if they have a federally backed mortgage and live in a FEMA flood zone, or if they've already received FEMA assistance for previous flood damage.
But when FEMA maps the flood risk, they do not usually include rainfall-related flooding.
Carolyn Kuski is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
So you have people who didn't realize that they were at risk of flooding now getting flooded.
And if they don't have flood insurance, they're pretty much on their own. Regular insurance won't cover water damage, and there's very little federal aid.
People need to know, if you don't have flood insurance, your mortgage is at risk.
Former FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate says at this point, it doesn't matter where you live. Your home could flood.
The climate's already changed. Even if you eliminated all greenhouse gases today, what has happened is already in motion.
In the short term, he says, one of the best ways to build resilience is to get more people to buy flood insurance. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Amid and about the almost daily back and forth about whether or not this economy is in a recession, there's a key point that has to be made. What you call it and when you call it that just doesn't matter. An economy fundamentally is about how people feel. And right now, people don't feel great. Businesses, neither. General Motors says it's going to cut spending and cut back on new hires. Walmart says its customers are cutting their own spending, so it's marking down inventory to move it. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, small businesses are getting ready for slower times, too.
The pandemic has changed the way a lot of small business owners plan for the months ahead.
Now we're wired in a way that we think about the future, that something major could happen. There could be a major shift.
That's Ken Gidden, co-owner of Rothmans, a men's clothing store in New York. He says clothing sales have been great this year, with people going back to the office and going out to events. But the pandemic taught him to order clothing closer to the season instead of 3 to 6 months in advance like he used to.
There's a nimbleness and a flexibility that you didn't consider before in the buying process.
Instead of working exclusively with vendors who make products to order, Gidden says he's working more with suppliers that have clothing items already made in warehouses ready to ship. And he says he and his vendors have a new understanding that if the economy goes south, Gidden might have to hold off on an existing order.
And in the past, that would have led to a big dispute. But it's understanding, you know, that we're all partners in this thing. And sometimes things happen and both sides need to adjust.
Preparing for a downturn can be a challenge while consumers are still buying your product.
Believe me, we're all wearing like 5 different hats and we're exhausted.
That's Giovanni Prince. He's the founder of The Cracker King, a company that makes gluten-free crackers. Late last year, he outsourced his production to a commercial bakery. That's helped him expand production and sales, but it's also allowed him to reduce his employee headcount to just 3 people.
We are lean and mean, and we plan to stay that way, and it's hard.
Prince says he'd rather not hire any more people. in part because he'd rather not have to lay anybody off if there's a recession. Prince wants to ensure that his business can survive with a lean staff.
It hurts your heart when you have to let people go when you know they have family and whatnot. I'd rather be in a position where I have a small team and I know exactly what I need to do with my business in order to stabilize and stay successful and grow.
Hiring more employees is also getting more expensive as wages rise. But that's not the only cost that's rising. Supplies are more expensive, and so is shipping and rent.
When you have a fixed brick and mortar, day in and day out, you have to pay the bills.
That's Sophie Blake, owner of a jewelry store in Virginia. Lately, Blake's been worrying about what'll happen if her customer traffic slows down.
So if your landlord charges you X dollars for your rent, that's never going to change. You're still going to owe them that money, whether, you know, the economy is good or bad.
So Blake has decided to close her store and move the entire operation online. She says she'll still put on local pop-up sales and sell items through other retailers. But the goal of going online is to be in a better position to ride it out if her local economy turns south.
Your hope is that by reaching a bigger audience, more people learn about you, you get to acquire customers outside of your natural geography.
And if there's a recession, Blake says an online-only operation would also make it easier to reduce costs. For instance, she could cut back on advertising. That said, she knows there's no guarantee that the pivot will work out.
It's scary for me because I'm not comfortable in that space. I've always, for 7 years, our primary driver of sale was our in-store customer walking in and shopping with us.
Blake says she'll shut down her physical store later this month. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, and I don't know whose idea this was. It's important, by the way, that you know that even though I'm a dog person now, I grew up a cat person. But even so, I just can't quite make sense of this. Fancy Feast, the cat food brand from Purina, is opening up a pop-up people restaurant in New York City. But wait, it gets better. Here's the public relations quote, "The dish for humans," that exclamation point is in the press release, by the way, "The dishes for humans take inspiration from Fancy Feast Medley's recipes and pay homage to traditional Italian cuisine." And it goes on, Gatto Bianco, which is, I think, white cat in Italian. Gatto Bianco will bring the mealtime experience of cats to life for cat owners and cat lovers. August 11th and 12th, only if you are so inclined. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context. I saw this on Bloomberg this morning, the economic reality of the drought that we are having out here in California. The spot price of water on something called the Nasdaq Velez California Water Index hit a record high in late June, $1,144 an acre foot. That's how they measure water, the amount needed to cover an acre of land to a depth of 1 foot. Anyway, that $1,144, that's a 56% increase in the price of water out here since the beginning of the year. And yes, there is a case to be made. That's not a hard one to make, actually, that that is still too cheap. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.